Step into Mind Matters, where we reveal the high-stakes world of CEOs, from their first-day jitters to game-changing strategies, and equip you with invaluable insights and practical advice essential for your personal growth and leadership journey. And now, Mind Matters.
Welcome back, everyone. I'm Kendall Raessler, your host of today's exciting episode with my distinguished guest, Eric Dillon. On our podcast, Eric is not only the CEO of General Bank Canada, but he holds a wealth of knowledge and expertise. This episode is going to be filled with engaging and insightful conversation with Eric's journey. Get ready for an informative episode and welcome Eric to the show. Welcome, Eric.
Hey, thanks, Kendall. And, you know, just for the record, I'm not actually the CEO. I'm the president. And you're like, what the heck's the difference? Well, small difference. So just to make sure that we got the I's dotted and the T's crossed.
Absolutely. Well, thank you very much for that, Eric. I appreciate that.
All good. You know, Eric,
well, before we dive in today, I'd like to give our listeners more of an understanding of your background. So if you could share a brief bio of yourself and some highlights of your professional journey, that'd be wonderful.
Okay, so I started at, I'm a U of A grad here in beautiful downtown Edmonton, Alberta, and I started in chemistry, believe it or not. And then I realized I don't know jack squat about chemistry and I'm probably not going to be that good at it. And so ended up switching to economics and quite like just this idea of how money is connected to the world. And that's where I think I got interested in the idea of banking. So then I worked in kind of small, I've never worked in what we in the industry call the D-SIBs or the big six banks. I've always worked in small regional banks across both Alberta and Saskatchewan in a pretty traditional journey, like got to be a branch manager, then led, you know, eight branches, then 20, then 110. And then, you know, from there ended up running, you know, two small banks, one previous life in Saskatchewan, and then the one I'm running now. And so I would say I've always been a community banker, if you will. So just because when you work in small banks, you're typically connected to a certain geography or a certain type of business or what have you. And so I'd like to think I'm maybe more closely connected to the people we're trying to support financially than maybe, you know, the CEOs that sit in the ivory towers in Toronto.
That makes a lot of sense. And, you know, I love that your journey started from, can I say, the bottom up and moved your way up there. What was it like on your first day as the CEO of General Bank? What was it like?
Well, I'll give you the first day of my first CEO gig because it's probably more profound. At least it was for me. Yeah. So it's like, on one hand, you're exhilarated because you get the job, you know, and you get to be the decision maker and all the things that come with it. The title, you know, the money's certainly better. And it's exciting because it's the first time that you get to kind of own the business, right? And make the decisions for the business. And then I would say it's 50% that and 50% you're scared stiff.
Yeah.
And the reason is like I grew up in retail banking, both commercial and retail banking. And so I knew that part of the business really well. But again, if I was being honest, I'd never led a marketing department. I've never led an HR department. I'd never led a corporate finance function at a bank, you know, never led a wealth management business at a bank. And so like half the business, I actually, you know, had not worked in it. And so you're deathly afraid and you get this imposter syndrome about, well, why in the hell? How in the heck am I going to make this work if I don't know those businesses as well as the other business? And what was really cool about my first day is I hadn't been in the seat literally 20 minutes and my phone rings and it's a CEO who was one of my first mentors. And he's like, Eric, it's your first day. And right now, pardon my language, but you're probably shitting your pants. And yeah. It's going to be okay. And if you just need to talk to somebody, I'm here for you. I care about you. I want you to succeed and you can call me day or night anytime. And he hung up and I took a big breath. And then you just kind of get on with learning the business and starting to make decisions and starting to figure out where to from there. But it was remarkable that I was equally scared and excited. And then the power of mentoring for me, I've never forgotten that phone call. And so colleagues and friends that I have now that take on CEO or president roles, I'm, you know, usually their first phone call to say, hey, I've been there. This is probably what you're going through. And, you know, I'm here to help.
You see, Eric, the numbers of CEOs and presidents that I've talked to, they've all have mentors helping them and walking them through. And it is a big part. We all need that support around us. It doesn't matter which position you're at, whether you're the top, middle, or at the bottom of any company. And I ask, that brings me to the question is, when you take on the leadership and you're doing that and you have that scared feeling and that excited feeling, and now all of a sudden you're like talking about your marketing, that I've never led that part to part before. How did you mentor them for the culture that you wanted to have in your company?
First step as a leader, or frankly, if you're just anybody working in a business and you're, you know, making decisions of consequences, you have to understand, like, what is special about our business? What are we really, really good at? What are the risks in our business that, you know, that could really hurt us? And then what are we going to do about them? And of course, then it's not static either, Kendall, because the world's changing at a pretty rapid clip all the time. So I think lots of leaders show up. And again, going back to my example of when I first started, it would have been really easy for me to go, well, I'm the president or CEO, and I know everything there is to know about banking, and let me tell you how to do the finance gig. I'd never been a CFO. So that would have been a really, really dumb decision. Versus I show up and I'm like, well, there's things that I'm good at, and I know I'm good at. I know I get in connecting with customers. I'm good at strategy. I'm good at leadership development and building people. I'm good at innovation. But there's things I'm going to need help with. So the first thing was being really honest with myself and those that I was closest to, like, i.e. my team in the business, to be really candid about, here's where I think I can add some value for us. And here's where I'm going to need a lot of help from people in the room, because there's just parts of this that you know way better than I do. And it's hard to do that, because when you get that job, the first thing you want to do is, you know, I got the job, therefore I don't want to admit any imperfections. It's counterintuitive, but you'll be highly, way more effective if you're just honest with yourself and do a better job of leading self.
So Eric, you're the first one that I've spoke to of all interviews that I'm doing where they've actually said that. Check your ego, put it aside, know what you are good at, right? And then ask for help on that and check for the right people around you. And the reason I bring that up is because that's exactly what most CEOs, we've some brand new CEOs are finding, is that they, oh, I have the words, the three letters beside my name that says CEO or president beside me. I've got to be here. And all these thoughts and measures that we put onto ourselves and fears get put into there, which makes it very difficult. And honestly, just becomes a lot of noise and distraction and time away. So thank you for sharing that. I think that is something that will go really deep with a lot of new CEOs.
Here's the irony of this, Kendall. So when I got this job, my first meeting, which was on day two, I'm like, okay, here's what I'm good at. Here's what I'm going to need help with. Do you think everybody in the room there knew I was a first-time CEO? Do you think they'd all creeped my LinkedIn profile and found out what I used to do and where I came from? I hadn't worked with any of them. Of course they did.
Yep.
And if I would have showed up and not admitted that, they all know I'm a first-time CEO. And so pretending I'm something else, it's just the most ridiculous thing in the world.
So what lessons have you learned along the way that's been instrumental to your leadership journey?
The business world, what happens in terms of how people get promoted is they go find, so let's say you're a great mortgage advisor. You're really good at connecting with customers and helping them finance homes. So let's say the manager of the mortgage department, you know, leaves or, you know, gets promoted and that job's vacant. Typically what businesses do is they find the best contributor, the guy that was the best mortgage advisor. And they say, well, guess what? You're going to be the manager of the mortgage department now because you're really good at what you do. Mm-hmm. He's got no training on lead self. He's got no training on lead others. He's got no training on lead enterprises. He was a great contributor, and I'll give you that, but he was not set up to lead. And so the first thing people ought to be thinking about is, what does it mean to lead self? Who am I? What are my hot buttons? What kind of stuff drives me crazy? You know, what relationships work best for me, which don't? And then manage yourself. And if you get really good at that, then you'll get the privilege of leading others. And if you get really good at that, you'll get the privilege of leading enterprises. But we put people in spots and ask them to lead others when they have jack squat knowledge about how to coach and manage themselves in real time.
I agree with that as well. That's a very well-known thing that a lot of salespeople get pushed into management positions, and they're salespeople. That's what they love. That's what turns their buttons. How do you prioritize personal growth and development amongst, you know, the rest of your team? What type of things do you do for that?
I'll talk about like maybe self-development first. My biggest fear, Kendall, and it's been true, I've been a CEO or a president now for like, I don't know, must be 13 or 14 years. My biggest fear for that whole 13 or 14 years is that I won't keep up. So my own development won't keep up with what the business requires, because the world is changing so darn fast. Like when I was a first-time CEO, there you didn't have to know anything about AI. You didn't have to know anything about analytics. You didn't have to know anything about digital customer experience. Today, you wouldn't even get an interview if you didn't have those things prominent on your resume. And so, like, I've always just checked myself to say, are you committing enough time and space and energy to develop yourself at the same velocity as the industry is changing? If you aren't, you're in deep, deep trouble, because eventually you'll lose your ability to effectively lead the business. So that's, you know, job number one is kind of self-development. Mm-hmm. Job number two is when I'm coaching people, and I've been coaching people for 20 years, I finish every coaching meeting with a conversation about development, every single meeting. Like that might mean every month for some, might mean every 6 weeks for others, but it's like, what are you working on? How can I support you? What do you need from me? Time, money, energy, coaching. And then I spend lots of time observing people, because again, like if I'm their leader, I think they should expect me to help them develop at the pace with which the business will require. And if I haven't, and they end up with that scenario we talked about a minute ago where, you know, they're less relevant than they used to be, I take it personally that I feel like I failed them.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that. I also want to ask, looking back at your journey so far, 13 years is a good run. What are you most proud of? What have you achieved that you're most proud of?
Yeah, I mean, two things. I think one is, you know, the businesses that I've been working in for the last 15 years, you know, there's been lots of kind of innovative accomplishments. So standing up a venture fund, standing up an incubator as a bank, that was unusual. We got an award for a social finance project we did that reunited moms with foster care. So I'm certainly proud of those things and the business results, but I'm equally proud that that first mentor that called me on my first day, he made me promise at the time, and I thought it was kind of weird, but he said, you know, I'm taking an interest in you because, you know, I think you have something to offer. And I think, you know, you maybe have the potential to lead one day. But the only thing I ask of you is when you're in the same position I'm in, you take the same interest in other people. And I was like, yeah, of course I will. You know,
yeah.
And then I kept talking to him, and he would ask me from time to time, how are you making out with that? So I started keeping track of mentoring relationships and I'm now working on mentoring relationship 111 in my career. And I keep track because of that commitment I made to him some 20 years ago. And so to this day, when I mentor people, I say, and now there's 111 that I've engaged with, and I've asked the same thing of them. And just imagine, you know, if he was listening to your podcast, I'm not even sure he knows where I'm at, but he would know the span that he's created in terms of just building this as investing in others. And I'm extraordinarily proud of the investment I've made in other people.
As you should be. I have the personal knowledge of you and your company and some of the people that work in your company. And you've done a fantastic job with that, Eric. It draws a lot of energy towards you, and it is about solutions. It's about helping people. That's what we're here for. We're here to help each other in many ways. This is the purpose of Mind Matters.
Well, the primary job of leaders, Kendall, mm-hmm. is to build more leaders.
Mm-hmm.
That's job number one if you're in a leadership role.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Yeah, yeah, that makes... So building a leader and being a leader is a lot of work and a lot of plates, and you're spending a lot of time. How do you handle your work-life balance? Like, there's more than just the work that you're in. How do you spin all of those plates? Like, what techniques, what processes, what do you do in order to be able to handle that work-life balance?
This episode is powered by Onist AI. Onist's optimized onboarding process and minimized documentation result in an expedited and seamless financing journey for clients, enhancing their contentment and commitment. Through identity verification, financial data validation, and creditworthiness assessment. Our software empowers companies to make well-informed financing choices, bolster application speed and customer uptake by 30%, and cut operational costs by a significant 70% with Onist AI. For more information, visit onist.ai.
I would argue it doesn't matter if you're a CEO or you're an entry-level contributor. Everybody has, you know, life demands, work demands, school demands, family demands, and those things, like this idea that they're separate lives. You know, I got my work life and my family life and my home life and my sports life. Like, it's just a bunch of bull. Like, this stuff all has to fit in the same jar. And the goal is to be really clear with yourself on what are the big rocks in your life that you want to make sure you protect and don't drop on the ground. Be really honest with those that you're closest to and those that you care about what those things are. Because again, like, life is hard, Kendall. Like, things, I don't do a perfect job of managing all those things in real time. And sometimes I drop the big rock. And, you know, I'll miss something from my family, or, you know, there's something that I know that I care about doing, which is watching my kids play sports, for instance. If I, you know, don't get an opportunity to do that, I know I've feel like I've let myself down because it's something that I highly value. So it's just to try to be a bit better tomorrow than you are today and be gracious with yourself, because it's like, it's hard and life comes at you fast. And so just being honest with how good are you at it right now, and then tell the people closest to you so that they can actually help and invest in helping you make better choices with that. And then be gracious when you screw up.
That is really good advice, because most people actually don't put it into one jar. They try to separate it into different jars. And that causes, like, oh, now I got to have three calendars. I got to do this and I got to do that. And I got to do, and it becomes overwhelming for them. And as new CEOs that we've spoken to, and that they've had the challenge of that, that they're sitting there saying, well, how do I do all this? And they're working 18, 16, 18 hours a day trying to manage it all. And a lot of it is facades that's happening around them. It's not actually what's important. So if I were to put it into a couple of words, what I heard as well, Eric, is that you prioritize what the most important pieces are in all of them and into one jar. And by doing that, that keeps those big rocks really looked after. It doesn't mean that they don't get dropped once in a while. That's called life. It's very difficult. And forgiving yourself makes sense as well. I think that
also, if somebody's asking me to do something with my time that's going to compromise one of those things, like if I have a teammate come and say, Eric, I really need your help with this work project, and they know I'm heading out, you know, to do something that's highly valuable, like maybe I'm going to a mentoring conversation with somebody in our business and they're asking me to cancel that or set it aside, they'll only ask if it's really important, because they know how much that means to me. And then it's, we'll figure it out. But then they'll help protect the boundaries as much as I will. And, you know, again, God willing, 9 times out of 10, we'll do a good job of it.
That's awesome. Thank you for that, Eric. I'd like to change the conversation a little bit to about scaling. Okay. Everybody wants to scale. Everybody wants, in the tech world, in the banking world, they want more and more and more usually. Now you got to have your controlled growth and look after all of that. But what strategies have you employed to scale with your organization, whether it's expanding geographically or growing a service or product?
Yeah, I mean, this is one that maybe I'll have a bit of a contrarian view. I mean, growth matters. Our business was up, you know, 20% last year in managing assets and more than that in financial performance. But the pursuit of growth for growth's sake is, it's just a treadmill that never stops. And I've seen tons of businesses layer growth on what I would say weak or faulty foundation. So they haven't optimized the business process. They haven't, you know, said, what are we really good at? Like, where's our moat? What's the, you know, strategic competitive advantage we have in the marketplace? And let's make sure that we optimize that first, and then we'll figure out how to deploy that in more places. But this idea that you're just constantly chasing, you know, 15% compound annual growth rate, and you're just layering on suboptimal process on top of suboptimal process on top of suboptimal process, it's just a zero-sum game in my mind. So in our bank today, we're really good at indirect finance. In my first 2 years at the bank, I've spent more time trying to optimize that first And I've even been very honest with the owners saying, and if that compromises growth, it'll set us up for success down the road. And it has.
See, that is a different approach than I hear as well. Most times the approach is actually polar opposite of that, right? Compound, you got to do your 15%, which gets a lot of banks as an example, a lot of legacy, subpar products they're working on again and again and again, and then they're stuck. And then how do you change that? It makes it very difficult for that to be changed and difficult for the person to make any steps forward. And it makes your culture tough because scaling is not only scaling your products, not only scaling your people is the other part of it, not only scaling your people, but when you're scaling your people, how do you keep them to come along so your culture is the same when you're doing that?
Totally. And I think you get kind of endlessly consumed with growing at all costs. And my experience has been, and this is both as a bank president, but also as a venture investor in my previous life, is the unit economics are way more important than the top line revenue growth.
Interesting. Do you believe that a lot of your peers that are in the credit union community bank system, do you feel that they follow that same type of model?
Yeah, I mean, it's the challenge when you operate what I would say as a diversified bank. So all the products, all the payment types, all the lines of business, wealth, commercial, consumer, agriculture, all those things. It's really hard to focus on, a specific business line. We are very blessed as a small bank that we only have two or three business lines. And so we have the luxury of being able to like be really disciplined and focusing on how to make those just absolutely hum. And so, I would never criticize those that are slightly bigger than us but have infinitely more products because it's a very difficult task. And in my previous world, that's where I came from. And it's really hard to optimize all of those at the same time. You've got to like literally pick your spot and pick the one where you have the most competitive strength and then, make sure that you can be a, credible, market leader in that space. When you do that, then figure out how to grow.
Well, very wise words because brand new CEOs and our listeners that are out there have, like I said, are from new CEOs, mid CEOs to number of years in CEOs. And even the brand new CEOs have had the challenge that they don't really pick their spot, that they think they have to do so much. So the organization piece really pulls it in very well. How do you use What does technology play in your scaling process? And how do you leverage it to enhance efficiencies and customer members' experience?
It's the great equalizer today, Kendall. Like 20 years ago or 30 years ago, if you were trying to run a, three or $3.5 billion bank, or in my previous life, a $10 billion bank, it was really hard because scale offered tremendous cost advantages to larger incumbents. The Moore's Law is totally working with respect to technology, and the cost of those things has come down. You can like I can buy as much computing power now with AWS as the Royal Bank can, through the cloud. And so technology is the great enabler where I think it's created less disadvantages for very small banks. And then if you layer on top of that kind of the leapfrog advantages of AI and analytics and the things that are happening in that world today. I've deployed AI solutions in credit underwriting, again, in a previous life. And the irony is we said yes more times. So we approved more loans and lost less money. So the customer was happier more often, and we had a way better outcome in terms of losses. And that's not to say the people making those decisions, they're to be critical of them. They just can't process as many variables as the machine can. And it can, in that case, could predict losses with a higher degree of accuracy than people could just because the amount of data that could be consumed and processed and analyzed. And so why wouldn't we harvest that? And the cost of that transaction? So deploying an AI model, going from, a human making 10 decisions an hour to a machine making thousands of decisions an hour, the unit metrics go down. And the best part about this is you can take the highly experienced human decision-making power all the things the machines can't do, and then you can deploy them on the edge cases that require a higher level of judgment. So where maybe there's something unique about somebody's circumstance and an underwriter should spend some time digging into that and looking at it, that's where you want people spending your money. This isn't about laying off all the credit underwriters. It's about getting them adding value on the most complex cases.
I agree with you. People in, are scared of technology in scaling and seeing people scale because they're worried, oh my goodness, I'm going to lose my job. I'm going to lose this. I'm going to lose that. No, no, it's not a loss. I look back at the days when the horse and buggy was around. Now that's many, many years ago. But oh my goodness, when the car come in, oh, it's going to replace everyone. Everyone's out of a job. No, they just metamorph to a different position. And it allows you to keep better people into the right positions where you want them. And it keeps people competitive.
And I think it's partly what's going on in banking is we say, you know, I hear from the bankers that I hang out with from time to time that, oh boy, we better be scared about the fintechs and they're not regulated and we got to be careful. It's going to be the wild west of money management. You know, that sounds to me like what taxi cab drivers said when Uber was coming along. We should just regulate them and make them go away. And what we forgot about was the consumer actually wants an ability to order a ride from their window and not stand outside on a minus 25 Edmonton day and wait for the cab to show up. So if that's what the consumer wants, we should figure out how to deliver that. And in my case, if the consumer wants a mortgage done differently, or they want the money management tools that a NEO or a COHO are bringing to the market, the regulator is not going to get in the way of what the consumer wants. We should just figure out how to make it safe.
I agree. I agree, Eric. Eric, I want to thank you very much. We've come to the end of our time, and I wanted to thank you very much for your time. It's been very insightful, and I believe this will help a lot of our CEOs, presidents out there that are listening to this. Thank you so much for your time and your help, and I enjoyed speaking with you an awful lot, Eric. I look forward to talking with you more.
Yeah, it was great to be on the show. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you found this conversation valuable, please leave a review on your favorite podcast platform. We will see you next time on Mind Matters.